3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Living free.
Thanks to the Resident Frequency Radio Show for another great show, playing tracks and chatting with Collingwood artists. Welcome to Living Free, a one-hour show in which we highlight one of the many programs that assist in recovery from drugs, alcohol, gambling and food addictions. Our guests share their recovery story and highlight that shared experience saves lives. You're listening to the 3CR Community Radio. 855 on the AM dial or 3CR on digital radio or maybe even live streaming on 3cr.org.au. My name's Michael, and I'm joined in the studio by my co-host, Bill. Welcome, Bill.
Hi.
And today we've asked our guest, Lisa, to share their experience of recovery from alcoholism with the help of Alcoholics Anonymous. But before we do that, I'd like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, traditional owners of the land from which 3CR transmits people-powered radio. We'd like to pay our respects to elders past and present and to acknowledge that the material and spiritual connection of Aboriginal people to this land was stolen from them. Now, before we start, I'd like to remind you that the Living Free show may involve discussion of topics such as suicide, mental illness, self-harm and family violence. So please practice self-care and care of others whilst listening. Welcome, Lisa.
Thanks so much, Michael. Thanks, Bill. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you, that you could join us in the studio today. We like to start the show by asking our guests to, I don't know, share something a bit about their upbringing or their childhood. So what was it like to be Lisa when you were young?
I think when I first got sober, my childhood was full of woe and it was full of hardship. But looking back from this perspective, I had a pretty good childhood. You know, I came from a pretty standard family. There was me and a sister, a mum and dad, and, you know, I had access to all the things that I wanted. You know, I had a good education. And when I decided I loved horses, which many young girls get to that point in their lives, I was like, Mum, I want to go to pony club. And Mum and Dad scratched around and they got me some riding lessons, which was incredible. You know, I played a lot of sport and, you know, was pretty good in school. And, yeah, there was no great crime in my family or no great traumas or anything like that. There was, you know, normal sort of dysfunction and arguing and stuff like that. But generally, I think we were a pretty normal family.
Who's we? How many siblings, brothers, sisters?
Yeah, I've got a younger sister. So just the two of us. And then Mum and Dad, who, you know, they had their arguments and their, you know, whatever, but stayed together. No big divorce, no big acrimonious things happened. It was all just, it seemed very, very normal. Yeah.
So did you have that feeling that did you fit in with your people around you? Did you have, you know, good bunch of friends at school, primary school, and, you know, everything seemed to go pretty smooth?
On the outside, for sure. I think, you know, I always seemed to make friends. I, you know, dated boys in high school, and sometimes I got to date the ones I wanted to date, which was really nice, you know. There was no, like, you know, unrequited love or, you know, great yearning or anything, but I think on the outside everything was actually kind of okay, but on the inside I just never felt like it was. I didn't feel like a greedy sort of teenager, but the feeling was that I wasn't enough or that I was, you know, that I didn't fit in, you know, because there was this great sort of emptiness, I suppose, inside me, or that there was something wrong and that, you know, if people knew that I was empty and a bit broken on the inside in a way that I couldn't explain, that they'd be, you know, disgusted by that, and they wouldn't want to be my friend and they wouldn't want to date me. So, you know, just that that feeling of if people knew who I really was deep down, they wouldn't want a bar of it. And so I suppose I did what probably a lot of teenagers do. I put on a bit of a front and I put on a bit of a facade, and I was like, I'm this kind of girl and everything's fine, when, you know, on the inside I think I was pretty, pretty lost and pretty empty and just a bit clueless about where to go with life or what to do.
You're a teenager.
It doesn't seem that unique, you know. It just really seems like that is the normal human teenager experience, I think.
Yeah. So when did you start drinking? What
Yeah, what was your experience when you first started drinking?
Yeah, my first drink that I can remember was sitting in a botanical garden somewhere one Saturday night with a group of friends, and my parents had bought me a 4-pack of UDLs under the misguided assumption, I think, that if they just bought me 4, then I would only drink 4 and then they would, you know, feel comfortable letting me go to this party. But they bought my friend a bottle of Passion Pop as well, which was sort of the crappy, cheap champagne at the time. Mm. and so I drank my 4 drinks, and my friend didn't finish her wine because it was, quite frankly, like, disgusting. And I polished it off, you know, and I don't remember feeling super drunk and really loving the feeling or anything, but I was right from the get-go, I was like, I'll have more than I planned to have. I'm going to have more. I'm going to have as much as I can get my hands on. Another girl had got there with a, you know, like a flask of vodka she'd swiped from her parents', you know, liquor cabinet. And I was like, yeah, I'll have a go at that. And then regretted it instantly because it was disgusting. And, you know, but so I was always after more right from the beginning.
Yeah, it's unusual that it's not unusual that you must have had an environment of drinking around you. For how old were you when at that time? 14?
Yeah, so, probably.
So for your parents to go, it's okay for my 14-year-old to drink, means that there was drinking at home.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, my mum's the type that will have like one Bundy every day, but like just one, and sometimes she'll put half of it back in the fridge and she'll drink it later.
Alcohol abuse. That is alcohol abuse, absolutely.
But certainly my dad's a heavy drinker, and there's a lot of drinking, you know, in my family, in the, you know, the wider family, and I played a lot of sport growing up, so I was always around sports clubs where drinking was really big in the culture, and it wasn't just, we drank when we won, we drank when we lost, we drank after, you know, trainings when we hadn't even played a game. We drank on Sundays together at the club when there wasn't a game to play and we were all bored and had nothing better to do, you know. So drinking was just so, it was everywhere. It was all around me.
So you talked about growing up. So this feeling of being different, did it affect your relationships in who you developed relationships with?
Yeah, I think so. There was just this chronic low self-esteem, I think, that I could and I know the word self-esteem, you know, like I understand what those words mean, and yet I didn't understand that self-esteem should come from yourself. And so I lived for the praise and the validation of others. And so that started off with my parents when I was quite young. There's this funny experience I had when I reckon I was 5 or 6, and we were driving under the Westgate Bridge, and I saw the sign that said Westgate, and it said freeway, but it was just FWY, just an abbreviation. And I read the sign as a little kid. I was like, Westgate Freeway. And my mum turned around and went, oh, that's really clever that you worked out that that says freeway. And I was like, oh. And that when I hear alcoholics describe their first drink and how it lights them up, that praise lit me up the way that I think other people describe their first drink. And I remember that experience because a couple of weeks later we drove under the same sign and I tried it again and I didn't get the same response because my mum already knew that I knew what that meant. And so I was like, where is the feeling? Where is the praise? Where is the, oh, Lisa, you're so good, you're so clever? And it didn't come. And so, yes, all my relationships, I think, through my, you know, teenage years were driven by that looking for the praise, looking for the validation, looking for someone who would tell me I was doing good. Because I didn't know I was empty. I didn't know if I was doing good. I had to hear it from outside. And it made me needy in relationships, and it made me clingy, and it made me insecure and probably very unpleasant to be in a relationship with, to be honest.
Yeah. It's about people pleasing.
Yeah.
Which is a form of control. So you're trying to control their view of you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that I was a vegetarian for 15 years. Not because I really care about the environment or animals, but because I thought it made people see me in a certain light. Yeah. And I would cheat all the time. You know, I would eat meat secretly here, or especially a drunk night out, I'd cave and eat a chicken burger or whatever. But I thought that if people knew I was a vegetarian, they would think all these other things about me, and I wouldn't have to actually go to protests or actually fight for animal rights, because they would know, based on the fact that I was a vegetarian, that I was a bleeding heart lefty, and that that was a sympathetic good thing to be.
Oh God, I would hate to say that that's exactly me. I was the same. I was a vegetarian for 13 years, and it was so difficult for everybody else around me.
Yeah,
just to wear an animal liberation T-shirt.
Yep,
and it was a way to pick up girls. It was if I look at my motives now and go, oh,
yep.
But it was all about what other people thought of me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the other thing is that you didn't have an opinion on things, that you waited for other people and sort of aligned with those, and it's a. The worst part of people pleasing is when you go to the next extent and trying not to displease them. So you're trying to figure out what they want and trying not to do those things. Yeah, that's really it wrecks your brain.
Yeah, I have a funny relationship with people pleasing, because I know that the things I do don't please people very much, even though I'm trying to get them to like me. But the thing is, the idea that I would even know what someone wants is laughable, because I've got no idea what the people around me want. I act in the way that I think I would appreciate in their situation, and then get mad at them when they don't appreciate the things that I do for them. Like, it's so delusional. I feel embarrassed saying it, but it's the reality of the situation.
It's definitely the question I get asked is, if you call it people pleasing, how many people did you please?
That's right. Yeah.
None. And not many at all, but we still call it people pleasing. Why don't we just call it fear?
Yeah.
Fear of what other people think.
Yeah.
And we'll just be straight up, it's called fear of what other people think. So you started drinking, you enjoyed your drinking during your teenage years. There wasn't obviously a lot of catastrophes. There wasn't, So what happened next? What happened next? Where did your drinking take you from, late teens?
I wasn't sort of the sort of kid that lived to drink on the weekends, but I think for me around the 18, 19, 20 mark was when real life started to hit, and all of those big life decisions, what job or what career I was going to embark on, whether I was going to do any study, was I going to move out of home, where was I going to live, all that sort of stuff. When the real world hit and I had to sort of start being an adult, that's when the drinking sort of escalated for me. Especially when I moved out of home, anything that felt stressful, I could go to the bottle shop because I was old enough now. And, I still had days where I didn't feel driven to drink every single day. It really was for me that slow, progressive, just inching in little bit by little bit. And, there were big moments. Like, I had a breakup with a boyfriend where I went home afterwards and I bought a bottle of Jim Beam on the way, and I sat at the kitchen table in my parents' house and I drank it until I passed out on the floor. And I started about 10 a.m. and my mum came home, I think, at like 2 and found me passed out. So there were bigger sort of alcoholic-themed events, but overall, like, my daily life was – it looked – to me it looked like my drinking was the same as other people's drinking. But then as my 20s went, everybody else started to slow down. They did things like they got married and they bought houses and they had kids and got promoted at work and all that sort of stuff. And I was kind of floundering around in different careers, kind of going, how come these things aren't happening for me? How come I'm not getting promoted at work? Another bloke that worked for the camera crew that I was on, he got a job over here at this other place, and I was like, I'd be way better at that job than him. But I didn't apply. Like, I didn't write a resume. I didn't ask about it. He did, and he got the job, and I sat back drinking my beers at the sports club kind of going, how come I'm not in that job?
Well, they didn't send a scout out to the locker rooms to find you there.
No, they didn't. They didn't read my mind that I wanted that job, which I only decided in hindsight that I wanted after he had already got it.
We might take a break and we'll play some music and we'll come back and we'll hear what happened next. You're listening to Living Free on 3CR Community Radio. Where we would encourage our listeners to become regular donors to 3CR by becoming a regular donor. Your ongoing support ensures that we can continue to provide a platform for community issues and struggles. jump online and go to 3cr.org.au to become a regular donor, or call the station during business hours on 9419 8377. Today we're talking with Lisa about alcoholism and recovery through Alcoholics Anonymous. So before the break, you gave us some insight into the introduction to alcohol. Maybe we'll move forward in time and see where you're at when alcohol became troublesome. What happened next?
Yeah, look, for me it was definitely a slow, progressive thing, and there was no kind of tipping point where I think things went off the rails. But what I did through my sort of 20s was I relied more and more on alcohol and sort of pulled it closer and closer and it further into my life, I suppose. So, and it started with, you know, things that didn't seem alcoholic at the time, you know, things like I was talking before about, you know, sitting around at the sports club and just drinking beers and kind of settling in for the day. And I had a pretty close work friend's engagement party that evening. And, you know, I just, after I'd had a few beers, I just didn't want to go anywhere. I was happy where I was. And I just, and so I didn't go. And that poor friend was so hurt, you know, that, I, you know, we haven't spoken since. And so that to me was like, oh, you could kind of brush that off and go, it was a mistake. It was a mistake. Poor decision making on my part, my bad. But more and more events like that started to string together, and I started to hurt more friends. I started to upset my family members. I was turning up to work really hungover a lot, and my ability to do my job was compromised. And I couldn't see that these were repeating patterns in my life, and that they were happening so often, because I was getting drunk every other day, and I was forgetting about it. And, you know, and the frequency of the drinking was picking up as well, you know. So I went from like probably a Friday, Saturday drinker to a Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday to then every night. And then over the span of a few years through different jobs, you know, I ended up with a job at one stage where it was a corporate job and we would often go to pubs for lunch. And so everyone would have a pint at lunch and I was like, oh, this is gross. You know, drinking at lunchtime was good. And then, I don't even know when it happened, but the physical side of it kicked in, you know, and I would wake up with the shakes, and I would wake up knowing that the only thing that would help me feel better was a drink. And so the morning drink crept in, and I was doing the red wine in the coffee cup and or in the thermos and on the train on the way to work. And I, like, I knew that stuff was a bit off the rails, you know. I knew that normal people didn't do that. But I still wasn't quite ready to say, oh, I'm an alcoholic, I have a problem, I need to do something. I just thought I had a bit of an interesting way of getting through life, you know, and I thought it was working for a time. Yeah.
So do you want to sort of talk us through a day in the life at that point, like from waking up to give us a day of the alcoholic?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I'm thinking of this particular corporate job at the around that time, because things really scaled up in terms of my drinking then. And
how old were you? Sorry.
Like 24, 25, something like that. I was working as a corporate concierge for a company. So I was the face, I was the receptionist and, you know, the face of the first person they see when they walk in. And yeah, a day in the life. I shouldn't have been in this job in the first place, you know. it went so far against my personal values, you know, and I had no ability to analyze these things back then. I was too young and I was too busy drinking, honestly. But, you know, I had no ability to look at a job and go, oh, that's for me, or no, that's not. You know, it was all just let's get some money in the bank by any means necessary kind of thing, even if it means doing something that I hate every day. So that was the context for the job that I was in. But a day in the life would be like waking up, you know, snoozing the alarm two or three times, finally having a shower, having something to drink in the morning. Usually I had a 4-litre cask of red wine in my bedroom by that stage, because if I left it out in the kitchen, everybody could see how much I was going to it. So I put it in my bedroom so no one could see. But people can tell. I found out it smells and you can, yeah. So I'd like rush through a shower, try and get myself presentable for work, drive into work. Go into the underground car park near work, and like inevitably some catastrophe, like, you know, bump somebody else's car, or, you know, not find a spot and park somewhere that was not technically a parking spot and come back out to a fine later in the afternoon and be upset about it, even though, like, I had clearly done the wrong thing. And then, yeah, just fumble my way through the day. Sometimes I'd take booze to work with me. Sometimes, because it was a corporate job, they had sort of like a Friday night drinks thing, and so there was wine in the fridge. So I would, if I was really hard up, I would drink their wine, refill it with water. I was like, no one will notice, and we'd get to Friday night drinks, and people would be like, this wine has gone off since it's been in the fridge. And I was like, oh, yeah, it has. It's gone off. That's the problem with it. You know, and just always getting caught at work, you know, doing stuff I shouldn't be doing, even if it was just like, you know, cruising Facebook or something when I should have been doing other stuff. You know, I was just always doing the wrong thing, doing the thing that I knew I shouldn't have been doing, but doing it anyway because it was more interesting than what I was being paid to do. So even though it's not directly connected to the physical act of drinking, the alcoholism was alive and well in, you know, my priorities and my self-absorption and the fact that I wanted to do this when I was being paid to take messages and clean meeting rooms and refill the printer with paper so people could get their jobs done, stuff like that. So
did you take care of your eating?
No, I couldn't eat towards the end. That slowly tapered off. And if I'd had enough to drink, generally I could eat junk food. Yeah, no, my eating tailed off in a big way and I was really deficient in a lot of things, and I had a couple of vitamin B injections at the GP, and I didn't know what they were or the significance at the time. All I knew what it was like sunshine in a vial, and I would get one and go, oh, this is great, and I'd feel great for like 2 days. Oh, maybe not even that long, maybe half a day, and then I'd, you know, it'd tail off again. And you know, I avoided the GP as much as I could, because every time I went there, she would give me bad news about, you know, she'd tell me my liver had alcoholic hepatitis. And I remember when she told me that, I just went straight to the bottle shop to buy 4 litres of wine to forget that she had told me that, you know, because it felt too big and too scary to address the physical damage I was doing to my body.
Mm. So were your parents concerned about you?
Yeah, probably for a lot longer than I even really anticipated, I think. I did quite a few geographicals in my 20s. So the first time I went up to Scotland and I lived there for a bit. When I went over, Dad said, don't you go over there and spend all your money on tattoos and then call me asking for money. And within the first 2 weeks, I'd gone to the London Tattoo Convention, blown 300 quid on a tattoo, and then we used Skype back then, and Skyped him and said, I need some money, I'm broke. So I did that time, and then I came back, and that was actually in pursuit of a boyfriend. And then a couple of years later, the same thing happened. I met an American boy here, and he went back over to Denver, and I went with him and said, oh, Mom and Dad, can I borrow like $3,000, you know, and I'll pay you back, and went over to Denver, and I was just a sinkhole for money, and ended up coming home. That relationship blew up, didn't work out. Shocker, you know.
Amazing.
It was like the worst kept secret green card marriage arrangement that, you know, has ever existed. But yeah, I came home and ended up living with them, sort of just in what used to be my childhood bedroom, I suppose. And so I didn't think they were worried about me during that period, but I'm sure their wallets, you know, were worried about me. But when I was living with them, I think they started to see, you know, how much I was drinking, how much time I was spending alone. You know, I think that was a big part of it, that I spent so much time isolated in my bedroom and I was so unwilling to open the door. You know, like I would wait until they had gone out the back for a smoke to go to the bathroom, you know, because I just didn't want to face anybody, didn't want to talk to anybody. And look, it was my mum really that she, I think, was the bravest one of all of us, because I would go out during the day and take a big black backpack, kind of like the one I've got here. Oh, actually this exact one. And I would go out and come back and she'd be like, what's in the backpack? And I'd be like, nothing. She'd be like, open it up. And I'd be like, no, it's mine. This is my privacy. How dare you? You know what I mean? And I always had booze and I always had wine in the bag. And when she started doing that, I started buying flasks because I could tuck them down the front of my pants and suck my guts in so you couldn't tell that they were there. So, you know, she was the one clearly worried about me that would actually kind of challenge me and bail me up about things. And I didn't see it as care and love at the time. I was just outraged and angry and resentful. But I now very clearly see that she could see her daughter was going off the rails and, you know, was having a really hard time. And she didn't know any other way to try and reach me, because whenever they would ask, how are you going? Are you okay? I'd be like, leave me alone. I'm fine. Get away. You know, so yeah, clearly very worried. But I was a prickly person to approach towards the end. So it was hard for them to get through.
Yeah. It's about control. Yeah. You're prickly, so they won't ask you questions. So,
yeah.
Prickly is good.
Yeah. Yeah, it works in my favour. Yeah. Or not.
Yeah. So what brought you to your knees? What was the thing that even if it wasn't just one event, what decision did you make, and how did you keep the decision? Did you make a decision to stop drinking and go, now that's it, and I'm going to go and take some serious action about this?
Yeah, no, not really. I went back and forwards on the drinking, on whether it was a problem for a long time, and I went back and forwards over and over and over again. And I tried to quit on my own, you know. I was like, I'll just go cold turkey. I didn't understand any of the dangers of that kind of thing. So I was like, I'll just stop. So I went from drinking 4 litres of red wine a day to nothing. And it was horrible for the first day. And then the second day would be a little bit less horrible. And the third day, maybe I'd come good around like lunchtime and maybe 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And that was about as long as I could hold on, and then I would have a drink, and then it would start all over again. So,
it's just the classic cycle, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's just the cycle of it.
Yeah. And there was the bargaining as well. You know, there was always like, oh, one wouldn't hurt. One, you know, I had no concept that one would lead to 100, you know. So I would like, oh, I'll just have two. I'll just go buy a six pack. I'll just do this. And no amount of trying to limit the drinks that were in the house or limit the type of alcohol I was drinking or counting bottle caps was something that someone recommended to me. What a silly one that is. Like, that's, yeah, no amount of those controlling behaviours worked for me. And so it was just, you know, I'd try and swear off, and then I'd buckle again, and I'd feel bad about myself, and I'd drink more, and then I'd try and swear off. And, you know, I used other things to try, you know, like I started a law degree. I thought that would keep me sober. I was just drinking in class, you know. I started a master's in publishing at a different university and ended up taking boxes of wine to class with me to stay topped up. So, you know, I thought I was trying all the things, you know, but, you know, none of those things were designed to stop me from drinking.
So when did you stop?
Well, my parents were the ones that sort of said, enough's enough, you can't keep living this way. Because I was 28, I was living in their spare bedroom, I was very physically sick, I was very emotionally unstable. I had been prescribed some antidepressants at one stage by a GP, and I had not taken them as prescribed. So there had been a few suicide attempts in blackouts that I actually didn't remember and didn't know anything about until I got sober. And so my parents were the ones that were like, you can't keep doing this. You need to do something about your drinking. And so they signed me up for a government-run rehab, and they sent me off to a detox, and then 10 days in the detox, and I went into rehab. And, like, I was still fighting, you know. I certainly wasn't surrendered when I went to rehab. I was angry about having to be there, and it felt like an injustice, and I was a bit ashamed of myself. There was a bit of I can't believe my life has come to this, you know, because I was a good student and a good athlete, and how did it all come undone? And there was resentment towards my parents, like, how could you betray me like this, you know? I was just living my life. I wasn't hurting anyone. I was just drinking the way I wanted to drink. How could you? So that went on all through the rehab. And I would suggest it probably wasn't until I came to AA and started the steps with a good sponsor. I don't think I was surrendered at all until I was probably into the steps.
So let's just put a time frame, because we had a conversation before the show, but, you know, so the rehab was 18 months.
Yeah.
So there's a time of making the decision to not drink and going to rehab and detox, and then being introduced to a solution that isn't just white-knuckling and holding on and waking up in the morning and making a decision, today I'm not drinking and I'll hang out with other people who don't drink, so therefore that's going to make it easier. And
yeah,
I'd call it the Washingtonian solution to not drinking, you know, the conviviality with others. Hanging out with other people who tell their war stories, and so therefore I get reminded that I shouldn't drink, but really just going, how the hell am I going to do this? So you, at the end of 18 months, you've gone to AA from there?
Yeah. I was, like, rehab was great for that, in that there were other people struggling with the same thing that I was struggling with, and I had, you know, felt for a very long time that I was the only screw up in the world that was going this badly, you know, that was doing and saying these awful things and hurting their loved ones and you know, destroying themselves along the way. So coming to rehab there was a bit of that relief when I realized other people had the same struggle and that they were trying to find a solution as well. And of course, just the regularity of eating and working and sleeping on a routine helped a lot. And talking about my feelings helped, you know, like I sat in some incredible therapy sessions where I still remember this woman who was a little bit further ahead in the rehab than I, she'd been there longer. And she said three things out loud. The first one was, I feel like I'm not good enough. And I heard her say that and I went, that's not quite me, because I actually think I'm like it in a bit. Like, I actually think I am good enough a lot of the time. And then she said, I feel like I'm unlovable. And I was like, I don't think that's it either, because I know people around me love me. I know they do. And then the third thing she said was, I feel like a burden on everyone around me. And I went, oh my God, that's it. That is what I have felt my whole life. That is that broken, empty feeling. That's what's connected to it. Those are the first words I'd heard that summed it up. And that changed, you know, like something cracked open for me there, where I was like, oh my God, if I share this crazy stuff that's going on in my head with others, I'll feel a bit better and I'll feel a bit lighter, and maybe they'll have some ideas that might work. You know, I was open to other people's suggestions for like the first time in my whole life. So that stuff was incredibly beneficial, I think, even though I was a dry drunk all through rehab. I think that sort of fellowship that I experienced there was great.
Yep.
But it wasn't solving my alcoholism problem, because I drank hand sanitizer while I was in rehab. You know, like I was 8 months in and I
straight?
Was yeah, I didn't, oh, mix it with
didn't
anything.
Mix it with anything.
Yeah. Right. Should I have put milk with it? I don't know. That's what they do with metho, I think. Yeah.
Orange juice and metho.
Orange juice. Oh, that would have been way better. No, it was like a lotus flower flavor, and it tasted like hand soap, and it was so yucky. But I'd had 8 months of feeling and looking and being better, and the insanity of the alcoholism just struck out of nowhere. And I'd never drunk chemicals before, but something about this moment, it pushed me to a new bottom that I didn't know I'd had. And so that was the point where I went, oh my God, there's more to this than just not drinking.
Great time to stop, actually. We'll take a break. That was excellent. I can't believe your timing on that. It was amazing. So we'll listen to some music and we'll come back and talk about what life looks like now. Welcome back. You're listening to Living Free on 3CR People Powered Radio. If you'd like to listen to one of our many podcasts, then you can find us on your preferred podcast platform, or just search 3CR Living Free and check out our website. Today we're talking with Lisa about alcoholism and recovery with the help of Alcoholics Anonymous. So, thank you so far. It's been wonderful to listen. Okay, so what's life in recovery looks like? What does your life look like now, and what has Alcoholics Anonymous done to allow that?
Oh, yeah, look, I have a lot of the same things in my life that I had before, I suppose. You know, I'm lucky enough to have had relationships repaired with, you know, my family and lots of friends and lots of communities I was a part of before, sports clubs. I live in a similar area. But Alcoholics Anonymous has made me grateful for all of those things. And I was one of those people that would roll their eyes at all the speakers that would say, I'm a grateful alcoholic. And I'd be like, gratitude, give me a break. Oh my God, go write a list. But I am a grateful alcoholic today, and I feel gratitude about some of the smallest things. You know, like I walked into stopped off to get some stuff the other day, and I walked into a pub to use the toilet, and I held the door for this old bloke as he came in after me. And then, you know, just because Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me to just think a little bit more about others, just even in the tiny things in life, held the door open for him, and I walked in and I looked around for the toilet, and he walked past me. He must have been a regular, and he was like, pointed me in the right direction, must have just read my mind that I was looking for the toilet. And I had this enormous swell of gratitude in that moment, not just for being pointed out, you know, where the toilet was, but just that I moved through the world in a better way today that has consequences that are better, you know what I mean? Like, in these tiny, tiny little instances and interactions with people where my, and I do a set of readings you guys probably might be familiar with, where they often talk about the angle of approach, and the way I approach every day is so totally different. It's positive and it's open and it's honest and it's willing to the best of my ability. Not every day, everyone has bad days, you know, but when I approach life and the day that way, I have incredibly good results. And it makes it so easy to be grateful, because my life is full of nice smiling at strangers on the street, and, you know, saying thank you to the checkout person, and having them, like, you know, I don't know, slip something in your bags extra or whatever, you know, just like little stuff like that that never happened to me before, and never it never occurred to me to behave that way. So even though I have a lot of the same things in my life, the way my life looks today is incredible. It's so much better than it ever has been.
Mm. It's also about respecting yeah. others, yeah, and their right to live their lives the way they like.
Oh my God! And yeah. just and the fact that they have a very complex inner life, just the same as I do. Mm. You know, they have a whole brain full of wants and needs and desires and thoughts and beliefs and motivations, just the same as me. And so my little machinations and schemes and trying to control people and trying to make them do what I want, or see them, make them see me the way I want them to, is ultimately, it's such an arrogant, selfish, horrible thing to do to another person, to try and make them think or do something different, because they've got all that stuff themselves. Like, they've got a whole life and a set of, you know, they're autonomous and they've got their own journey. Like seeing it that way is so different, and it's... Yeah, it's helped me get back inside, like, my hula hoop, and just, you know, think about my own words, actions and reactions, as opposed to trying to be the puppet master of all the people around me, which I was never any good at anyway.
No. Is that yeah. and I guess the outcome of that is that it makes us useful to others. And that's been my experience in 12-step fellowship, is that the solution to the problem I suffer from is getting useful.
Yeah.
I thought it was about getting happy, and what they've done is they've gone and hidden happiness behind usefulness.
Yes.
What a bloody horrible place to hide it. Like, I'd never think to look there. But you get to do, because we have this different perspective.
Yeah, yeah. I've definitely found that you know, I thought it was about making myself feel good as well, you know, and like my 12-step work, you know, I do a bit of stuff in the detoxes, and I'm on the phone lines, and I love helping alcoholics, you know, to the best of my ability. I love working with alcoholics. But I had a really beautiful older sober member from the Western Suburbs who passed away not long ago, and he pulled me aside after a meeting one day, and I'd been talking about the junior baseball team that I coach, which has been an amends to my baseball club for having stolen money and booze and stuff. They asked me to coach one of their junior teams, and I was up there at the meeting. I must have been, you know, complaining about how hard it is to deal with kids these days or something like that. And this older sober member pulled me aside, and he was like, Lisa, that's part of your 12-step work too. Like, you're a leader of men now. You're a leader in your community. This is you. This is your opportunity to give back to the communities, and that's part of your 12-step. And that really broadened my mind around being useful and around helping other people, because it's not just the newcomer that comes into the rooms. It absolutely is, but it's anyone in my orbit that looks a little bit alone or a little bit lost or a little bit afraid or a little bit unsure. You know, it's my boss at work being useful to my boss. It's I sing in a women's choir, and when a new person comes into the choir, there's 110 of us. They walk in and their eyes are huge and they've got no idea where to go and what to do. And Alcoholics Anonymous taught me how to walk over to people like that and put my hand out and say, hey, how you going? I'm Lisa. Are you new here? Do you know where to get this? Do you know where to get that? And I never had that awareness before, but I can be useful. And you're right, on the other side of being useful is like self-esteem and happiness and contentedness with my life and what I have and what's around me. It's a miracle.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's like you and I, we've only met once. We met at a youth detox in Footscray. Mm. And, you know, and with one person sitting in that room, like yeah. that one person sitting there and who thought he knew a lot, and which was cool, but you're sitting in detox and that's, and you know, and under the age of 20, and it's scary as hell. And we go there, not because it's a big note out ourselves, we're just going there because that one person needed to hear a story maybe from one of us that that there's hope.
Yeah.
There's a message of hope, and you know, Alcoholics Anonymous offers hope.
Yeah, it does. And that was my, you know, towards the end of my drinking, my fundamental problem was that I was hopeless. You know, I had people around me that loved me, and there were services, and there were Alcoholics Anonymous existed, and I had been to a meeting here or there, but I was hopeless. And so there was just no motivation to act or to take any responsibility or do anything about it. And since coming into AA, I've been introduced to so many different actions that I can take through my day or through my week that can get me out of, you know, a situation or get me out of a funk, or if I'm feeling resentful, if I'm feeling fear. There's so many, you know, from reading the literature to calling people, calling my sponsor, going to a meeting, helping somebody else, you know. Something as simple as just smiling at a random person on the street can lift my spirits, you know. So there's so much action that I can take today to feel a little bit better or to work towards feeling better. That it's just that there's no excuse for me to dwell in the self-pity anymore. Mm. You know, there's so much stuff to do, and that's where the hope comes from. You know,
yeah. I have a friend who says that, you know, desperate is nice, but hopeless is better. And when you get in, because you know that's you know, whatever, desperate, but hopeless is a great place to start.
Yeah,
because you know, no one comes to AA on a roll. No one comes in on a basis of, oh, my life's going so good, I just thought I'd add it to my resume.
And if anyone is a little bit like that, you know, they've got probably got some more digging to do.
Go and find it. It's like maybe you can.
Yeah.
Maybe you can manage that life you've got. Well, thank you. I think that we're going to wrap it up. And thank you for coming into the studio and sharing your experience. It's been awesome to listen to you and to engage. If you'd like to find out more about Alcoholics Anonymous, then you can phone them on 1-300-222-222, or you can go online to aa.org.au. That's all the time we've got for today. So I'd like to thank Lisa for coming into the studio and sharing her experience, her recovery experience with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been really fun.
Cool. Yeah. And I hope that you'll be able to join us again next week when I will be speaking to Rick about his recovery in Narcotics Anonymous. And coming up next, we have Bullum Wah, The Spirit of Wah, hosted by Uncle Teljum Choco Edwards. Join Uncle Choco in The Spirit of Wah on a journey of belonging and movement through sing-alongs and yarns. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and stay tuned now for more Radical Radio on 3CR. And to take us out, we've got some more music.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.